welcome to this podcast to talk about The Spectator's Economic Disruptor of the Year Awards, coming to you from the offices of Julius Baer in the City of London. I'm Martin van der Weer. I'm the business editor and any other business columnist of The Spectator, and I've got two guests with me, Tracy Reddings, who is the head of front office for Julius Baer, and she'll tell us what that means in a moment, and Rory Sutherland, who is vice chairman of Ogilvy, the advertising group, and is, of course, the Wikiman columnist of The Spectator. So welcome to both of them. So first of all, Tracy, tell us a bit about your own role at Julius Baer and the development of Julius Baer's business in the UK.
Thank you, Martin. My role at Julius Baer is really to work with our high net worth and ultra high net worth clients here in the UK and Ireland, of which there's a significant proportion of entrepreneurs that we look after, which is why partnering with The Spectator for the Economic Disruptor Awards was an exciting opportunity for us. We strongly believe that private businesses are important to the economic growth of the UK. And I think anything that we can do to encourage that entrepreneurialism and finding the next generation of entrepreneurs is fantastic for us. And we will continue to help those in the development of their businesses.
And we've certainly, between us, managed to make contact with an extraordinary range of entrepreneurs and innovators who've entered for this award scheme. So I think we have achieved that goal at the first stage. Turning to Rory. Rory, you're one of the best known advertising men in London. You describe your own role, I see, as seeking out those unexpected and inexpensive nudges that transform the way people think and act. So I'm guessing disruption as a concept is a very big thing in your business. Tell us kind of what it really means for you. When you see something that you recognise as a disruptor, what is it about it?
I think there's a very simple heuristic you can use about disruption, which is that any significant innovation fundamentally changes the way people behave. I'd say that of many dot-com and tech disruptors, too little time and possibly too little money is spent on this aspect of the thing, because there tends to be a kind of tech purist attitude that marketing should be unnecessary. They look at the success of Google, say, or other online brands, Facebook, Amazon, that have mostly been built without significant marketing spend and believe that it's their job to do the same thing themselves. But in many cases, to disrupt, it fundamentally requires that people start doing something differently. The force of habit is very, very strong. And so there are many, many good ideas that make beautiful sense on paper. They seem efficient, wonderful. They seem to offer significant cost savings, and yet people simply don't change their behavior accordingly. If you look at it, most people still keep their utility providers from one year to the next, even if they could save a little bit of money going elsewhere. And in the same way, habit and possibly the urge to actually preserve relationships in business are pretty powerful forces. And I think, therefore, there's a measure which is any really significant innovation, to be an innovation, not an invention, needs to show proof that people are simply doing things, large numbers of people are doing things in a completely different way as a result.
Yes, I'd say an interesting example may be Airbnb, which, of course, didn't invent the idea of homestay.
No.
But it has marketed it to the extent that many millions of people now think almost automatically or first of Airbnb.
It's become the Hoover of the category.
Yeah.
And certainly it's interesting to ask why, because you're absolutely right in saying there were two or three. There was VRBO, which was Vacation Rental by Owner, which was a very early American website, and also, I think, Home Away. Hmm. And yet, for some reason, they never captured the imagination in the way that Airbnb did, whether it was naming, whether it was pure accident of timing, which we can't forget, by the way. Mm. I mean, we tend to look at this through the lens of the efficient market hypothesis, as if the most virtuous always wins. But there's, you know, an extraordinary amount of importance to timing to succeed in this category. And of course, you don't always get to choose your timing.
But in that example, and in your world generally, in modern 21st century marketing, how much is viral word of mouth, as it were, and how much is powerful marketing ideas from the source?
I personally think that it obviously depends. I mean, we have here, if we look at our shortlist here, we have some examples where there's very much a niche audience. There's a piece of agritech where the target audience is farmers. It's fairly easy to reach those people, and word of mouth is going to be fairly powerful because they meet. In other cases, I think, particularly if you want to inspire consumer confidence, I'm a great devotee of costly signalling theory. The fact that you're actually investing something in promoting yourself at cost to yourself is proof of your long-term intentions and long-term confidence. And if you're asking people to bank in a new way or process foreign currency transactions in a completely new way or carry a new form of credit card, you've got to remember that when you sign up to one of those products, you're essentially committing for quite a few years. And you want to be fairly sure that the person you're dealing with plans to be in business for quite a few years. And so I think there's an extraordinarily overlooked thing in digital advertising that people have become so obsessed with what you might call the efficient delivery of micro-targeted messages that they forget the fact that actually upfront expense is proof of long-term intention, which, if you're going to be very unromantic about it, that's what an engagement ring is. It's upfront expense as proof of long-term intention. And if I'm going to suddenly take out a new card or move bank or trust a company to provide for me in some way, when I sign up and change my behaviour, I want to at least know that the company is planning to be and optimistically expects to be in business and repeatedly and widely popular for 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years. Because there's a huge danger here, of course, that you could very enthusiastically sign up for something only to find it didn't exist, 6 months later.
I think that's right. But I think the thing that is fascinating when you look across the entries, and the thing that really struck me, is that no real sector is immune from this whole disruption. Because if we look at the candidates that we have shortlisted, they touch every industry and sector. And I agree with you around the longevity piece. But actually, what's also interesting about the shortlisted candidates is that in many cases, they've identified a gap or a need or where a particular market is underserved. I think that's interesting. I think that the one thing, there's plenty of statistics which show the number of companies that fail within their first year or so. But I think, as you say, the key to their longevity is really going to be, one, that they have got their marketplace clear and they've got a sustainable model over the longer term. And recognise it takes 2 to 3 years to build the strong foundations before they then really start to scale up to the next stage. Because the next big challenge for any of these candidates is going to be the next stage of capital raising.
I think there's also a philosophical question we've got to ask, which is certainly in the tech field and in modern business lingo, it is assumed that disruption is benign. So we look at the word disrupting a market, and we automatically assume that this has to be a good thing. Now, we have to be a bit careful about this, because if you're disrupting it in a way that is genuinely long-term profitable, and you're actually making money doing what you do already, you can probably confidently say there's some healthy aspect to that disruption. On the other hand, you could argue that Amazon patently disrupts the retail marketplace in the UK, but Amazon's in a very peculiar position, unlike, say, Walmart or unlike, say, Sainsbury, in that it is so indulged by its shareholders that it doesn't have to make a profit.
Now, and it's fundamentally a monopolist, or would like to be.
It's gargantuan.
If you
actually free me from the obligation to make a profit for 10 years, or even more so, you allow me to lose $1 billion a year for the next 8 to 10 years, I can happily disrupt any market you choose. And the fact is that the indulgence of the tech sector by investors sometimes has poisonous effects. There's too much capital chasing too few ideas. And what may happen in some of these cases is that you suck all of the actual oxygen out of a category by super efficient appearing tech disruption. But if ultimately there's a gap in the market, but there isn't a market in the gap, you've destroyed a lot of perfectly worthwhile competing businesses or a lot of competing retailers. And you've done unaccountable harm to them. After all, I mean, we wouldn't regard it as fair if Sainsbury had to compete with a government-owned retailer that was subsidised so that it could actually sell goods at cost. So is it fair that Sainsbury or Tesco have to compete with a Silicon Valley funded retailer that doesn't have to make any money?
And if you took a sort of wider quality of life, social view, as it were, in some of these examples, how far would you really want, or would society really want, disruption to go? So we don't want Amazon to destroy the last high street bookshop. We don't want Uber to close down the entire
black cab
system. No. You somehow need a balance to be arrived at where all small and large players can continue to thrive.
Weirdly, fairly favourable towards Uber, because one of the things it seems to have done, and it's as much psychological disruption as anything else, is it patently has grown the market. Mm. You know, more people take taxis than did before Uber existed. You'd also argue, I think, that what black cabs have done is they've adapted their behaviour they've accepted credit cards, which was insanely overdue. They now focus more on shorter journeys in central London and leave Uber to have the periphery, which may make sense, to be honest. Mm. But there are other cases where, as you said, you know, how far do you want the disruption to go? I mean, to give a very simple example, Amazon doesn't really work without Amazon Prime, because nobody would buy 10 things a month from Amazon if they had to pay £3 delivery each time. Amazon Prime loses Amazon many billions of dollars a year. So you essentially say that in order for Amazon to have frequent customers, it's got to lose money. Now, no one asked this because, as I said, anything that can claim to be a digital disruptor is given a level of indulgence from the investor community that if I came along and had a property idea or I had an idea that was purely physical, I simply would not be able to enjoy the same indulgence from investors for 4 or 5 years as I would if I could claim I were a tech disruptor.
I think what's interesting, though, when we read through the case studies of the shortlisted candidates is the reality is tech is the enabler for the disruption.
For quite a few of them.
And I think we have to remember that at the end of the day, you still have got to have the creativity, the passion, the innovation. And I think encouraging that continued innovation is a good thing. I think encouraging healthy competition is a good thing for all the reasons that you mentioned in terms of the impact of Uber on black cabs as a very good example. But I think that what may be interesting with some of these candidates is that I also see an opportunity for some of these shortlisted candidates to be able to take this business and to take their ideas global, but also to cross sectors. I think that's the other interesting thing, that the tech in enabling their idea and their innovation enables them to cross boundaries of sectors as well. And I think there was one particular example in the shortlisted candidates, the Movem example, which is very focused on prop tech, but actually I looked at the idea behind that and I thought, well, you could easily use that idea in the financial services industry, for example, when you're doing your AML, your anti-money laundering checks, and you're checking out the clients as you take on new clients, as an example.
Yes, something that speeded up the 2 months it takes to open a bank account.
Absolutely.
That really would be disruptive.
And I would welcome that.
I want to take the conversation in two directions by sector, really. What was evident from the whole stack of entries for this, which Tracy and I have both read through, is there are two big strengths in UK entrepreneurship. So you can easily recognise. One is fintech, financial services meets digital technology, and the other is healthcare and bioscience. So I want to take those two topics separately. So in the fintech field, we have, of course, a market of very, very established large financial institutions and high street banks, heavily invested in the status quo, not generating high levels of customer satisfaction on the whole. So enormous opportunities for creative thinking in the area of fintech. And Rory, what was your feeling about the entries that you saw in that area?
I thought there were two to three of them, weren't there, really, depending on how you choose to define them.
Revolut is one.
Revolut is fascinating, which is essentially, it's a multi-currency credit card. So this is, as you quite rightly said, it's a product that's enabled by an app. And so you have essentially a smart card, but according to the app you use, you can choose in which currency you pay. And therefore, you can avoid the kind of heinous currency exchange fees that usually affect you. I would argue it's a niche product. I'm not sure that everybody who goes on holiday once a year is going to need this. But for a very certain kind of global nomad, it's going to offer significant savings. It also offers some sort of, and this is mandatory that we mention blockchain at this point.
Yes.
It seems to offer some sort of facility for trading Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies as well, which is interesting because it does seem to offer a bridge there between the world of virtual currencies and the world of real spending.
The Spectator editorially seems to be rather in favour of cryptocurrencies, but as its business columnist, I'm dead against them. So,
but I suppose it's their Hayekian,
but they're a coming thing.
And they probably have a Hayekian belief, don't they?
Yes,
that
they do.
Should be
exactly.
Multiple currencies.
That's
and
where
the
they
government
are.
Shouldn't have a monopoly.
Our other sort of pure fintech one is called Pocket. Its parent company name is Concentric, but it's Pocket, which is a sort of banking for the unbanked product. I think its website says, you know, open an account for 99 pence or something. And it's remarkable in the world today how many people are unbanked or how inaccessible financial services can be. Do you think, Tracy, is that a fair observation?
I think it is. And I think there is definitely a role for an organisation that can ensure that the financially excluded have access to financial services. The other thing I liked about what they're developing is that they create an environment for this category of customer to also start building up a credit score and a credit record. As we know very well, that's what makes it so difficult for them to have access for, and it's not just banking facilities, it's across the board in terms of their sort of everyday needs, in terms of setting up accounts for bills and all sorts of other things. So I do think there's a very great need. I think that the interesting thing again with this business is they seem to have done very well in building up a local and a national group of people that signed up for the service, so it's beginning to show there's a need. I think the key to scaling this up is if this is really something that can be applied globally, then this actually could be very exciting, I think, for what is, you know, we know an increasing gap between the very rich and the very poor, and ensuring that even the poor in society have access to good bank facilities.
I mean, there is an irony here, isn't there, that one of the most advanced countries in the world in terms of online banking is effectively Kenya, which is because of the strange role played by the mobile phone companies in enabling payment.
Yes.
I give particular commendation to this because I always give bonus marks to any disruptive idea where the target audience isn't people like people in the investor community. I think there's always a danger that we invest in companies that we ourselves would like to use. And if you think about the people who make investment decisions, one of the reasons they absolutely fetishize, say, online retail is generally they're cash rich, time poor. And so to them, anything that saves time or that streamlines their lives is seen as an inherent benefit. It's always worth remembering that actually half the population are looking for ways to kill time, not looking for ways to save it. And so I particularly commend this because it's looking at a group of people, it's looking at a market segment which isn't a mirror image of the kind of people who normally make these decisions and start these businesses. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it's incredibly easy to forget. I mean, there are, what is it, about 8 to 9 million unbanked people in the UK, I think, still.
Yes.
Now, if you have no credit rating, you know, essentially, you're going to reach a point where it's going to be difficult to function without a plastic card. I mean, I've
well,
pretty
even
much
now,
gone
just across
cashless.
The road, you can't go and buy lunch anymore with cash. They will only take payment by smart payment on
legal?
A card or phone. And I just thought, well, how does that work? Because not everybody wants to use cards. So I do think it's...
So, I mean, this is actually a very important and necessary technology.
And addressing the unsolved part of the sort of spectrum of financial issues. There's been very rapid disruption and advance since the financial crisis. You could say there was a wave of peer-to-peer lenders. There's a small but and struggling, still growing wave of challenger banks. The Kenyan mobile phone banking example you quote, I think, derives from a company based not very far from here called Monetize, which invented the
M-Pesa,
mobile phone.
Was it? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. that one. And so, and these have all happened quite rapidly, but that's still leaving behind a problem of the unbanked, the left behind, the people without the respectable credit score and so on. So that's a really important area I think we have identified in this. Yeah,
I think it's interesting your point about identifying a need that helps people to save time. I have to say the one that I found quite interesting, mainly because I am very time poor, and I thought this could revolutionise my life, is the digital PA for household admin.
Yes, in
OneDocs. I just thought, well, the theory of this, and I must download the app and have a look at it, but the theory of this is very interesting, and certainly if I was being very selfish about it, could help me manage my life a little better.
Likewise, if we move on to healthcare, so characteristics of the UK healthcare sector are concern about the capabilities of the NHS, growing demand on the NHS, growing budgetary pressures on the NHS, and so on. So very many of our entries were concerned with how to make it easier to get a GP appointment, how to make it better and easier for doctors to talk to other doctors, and so on, better communication, easier contacts, and so on. And that one of the ones, we picked two, I think, in this set of semi-finalists in London and the South, at opposite ends of the spectrum of healthcare innovation. One is called Echo, and it's the very simple idea of digitizing your repeat prescription procedure. Because the fact is, all of us who have any kind of repeat prescription have to ring up the surgery, drive round to the surgery. Sometimes they haven't got the drugs in stock and so on. And it's an enormous time waster and resource waster. And if it could be just digitized simply, that would be a wonderful thing.
And strangely, I mean, in the behavioral science world, we quite often have to work on the whole problem of patient adherence, which is just that, it's a very strange finding, people are much more assiduous at medicating their dogs than they are at medicating themselves.
Incredible.
It's a very strange thing. If your dog's ill and the vet says you've got to make it take this tablet, people will go to extraordinary lengths to make sure the dog takes the tablet. But when it's themselves, the levels of non-adherence are ridiculously high and waste a huge amount of effort and actually cause fundamental health problems. And what was interesting about this is they actually discovered what you might call a sort of spin-off benefit, which is that when you make it much easier and you automate the delivery of the drugs, adherence goes up really significantly. I think they quoted a figure here, in fact, that they said 89. They have adherence rates of 89%. Now, from what I know of this problem, that's impressively high. Mm. It may sound low to the audience, but you would be amazed at how many people actually are fairly strangely, I was going to use the word incompetent, I think that's probably unfair, but unreliable at medicating themselves. And 89% seems to be a really important spin-off benefit here. So I think that's it's a very, very beautiful solution to what seems like a very narrow problem, but to anybody who's in this position, it's a game changer.
Yes, I thought that was a beautifully simple idea. Likewise, we've got one in the north of England, actually, which is, I think, called Surface Skins, which is disinfectant touch pads for hospital doors. So instead of, as I was doing as I went on a hospital visit last night, bashing a door that was locked against me, then thinking, oh, I better do the hand wash thing to the side, you would have the disinfectant pad that would actually open the door and disinfect your hand at the same time. I thought, well, that's a
beautiful idea.
Yeah. At the other end of the scale, amongst this London and the South group, we picked out a very advanced bioscience business, Touchlight Genetics, in the field of DNA. This actually is perfecting ways of manufacturing DNA for all sorts of gene medicine, advanced medical uses, and claims a 10 times reduction in cost, time, capital expenditure, and so on for the process of creating DNA for medical purposes. But that one is an example where, of course, they don't do any marketing. They don't reach a customer. They basically will advance by doing licensing agreements with huge pharma companies, for example. So it's a more difficult one for us to judge, but that looked to us like a very important advance. And there are a number of those. Some we had to leave behind because they're not at the commercialization stage, but this one seemed to be at the breakthrough point.
one of those interesting cases where you have, for the investor in it, you have the potential for an immensely lucrative business with a remarkably small number of employees.
Yes.
But
yes,
which is
yes.
both terrifying and interesting. Mm-hmm. But I can see if their main income comes from licensing, could be a very, very interesting business indeed.
So are there any of the others that you would like to comment on? We had one very much in the consumer field, which is Car Wow, which advertises itself quite heavily on television. So that would meet your criteria,
mm-hmm.
Rory, and basically makes it easier and more efficient to buy a car from a mainstream distributor off the forecourt, but allows us, it's essentially a comparison site, I think.
As a little bit of consumer advice, unless you're at the very bottom end of the second-hand car market, I'm a great believer in using dealers. There's a huge tendency for people to sell cars second-hand as private individuals, essentially asking for a dealer price because they think that's normal, while providing none of the guarantees or assurances that a dealer would. So essentially, this is the eBayification of the stock, which is held by car dealers all over the country. And apart from anything else, it will enjoy... if you've ever bought a car, by the way, you know, you're told in theory that you can choose from 10,000 different colours, and you very quickly discover that black, silver and white seem to constitute about 95% of them. This is a way of actually essentially networking the forecourt stock of everything for the benefit of consumers who can find what they want without needless travel or without constraining their choice. I think it's an important idea. I'm glad they're advertising it because I think it deserves advertising.
Anything that makes the task of buying a car easier has got to be good, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So let's before we conclude, let's just mention, I think there are three we haven't mentioned so far out of 10 for this region. Hectare Agritech, Rory briefly referred to, but that one is about supply chain in the agriculture business. It's about livestock and grain online markets for those areas.
You could call it webuyanycow.com.
But we sometimes forget how important the food production industry and agriculture are. It's something I worry about because I live in the country. So a lot of my friends are farmers. So I think anything that makes their lives more efficient, they're very time short. I mean, right now they're out harvesting till it goes dark at 10:30 at night. So anything that improves their lives
and
is
a fascinating good
thing.
Efficiency they appear to have achieved already, where you know they use this example of, you know, having at any one time 10,000 livestock for sale, which is the equivalent of being simultaneously at 10 live auctions.
Yeah.
So there has got to be some interesting efficiency. Again, it'll be interesting to see how they could expand that further. They already talk about actually using it as a mechanism for exchange of grains and cereals as well, but I would imagine that there have got to be other areas to make the agriculture industry more efficient there as well.
And there seems to be a trust component, because this might lead us on to Moveum quite well. Mm. There seems to be a trust component as well, in that they found a way of ensuring full transparency of the animal health records, the age, breed, and past movements and past ownership. Because one of the things I'm always a bit alert to is these entities which, without actually really having a trust mechanism attached, simply commoditize markets. Because I think economists love commoditization because it improves ease of comparison. I also think it often leads to a kind of race to the bottom. You know, if you look at, for example, the horse meat crisis, that was really a product of the commoditization of the meat market,
yes.
where stuff is simply defined as approved beef. I'm a great believer in the brand, where the originator of the product attaches his name and therefore his reputation to the product itself. I would worry, too, about that automatic comparison engine for household utilities, because it creates a dangerous race to the bottom. In other words, your automated mechanism makes sure you have the cheapest gas, the cheapest electricity at any one time. One, that's slightly dangerous, because it essentially means that the most desperate provider in the market can essentially buy customers simply by hacking the algorithm. But also, it's great right up to the point where you actually need some customer service and you discover that they don't provide any. And so I think, you know, it's worth remembering that economists always believe you should just define what the product is and then buy it at the lowest price. But every time we actually buy something, we're also buying a kind of reputational insurance with it. And, you know, I'm always very uncomfortable about those dot-com ideas which are about pure commoditization. But the one I did, Movem, I liked particularly because it solves a very real problem of establishing your trustworthiness as a rental tenant.
Yeah. And actually great to see prop tech coming up in the categories. You know, we expected to see a high level of fintech and healthcare. We weren't surprised by that.
If there's one category that needs disrupting, it's property.
But that's the one area. And actually everything that I'm hearing is that prop tech is going to be the next big thing, you know, off the back of fintech is prop tech. And there's a whole swathe of new industries that are coming on board that are going to digitize this prop tech market. So I think very interesting category as well. And again, as you say, as we said earlier, this is something that, you know, whilst they're focusing on the property sector and the rental market, could be applied in other sectors.
And actually, if you think about it, I mean, the daftest thing, my father's been a residential landlord all his life, and he always says the daftest thing that landlords do is they get a reliable tenant, and after they've been there for 6 months, they try and put the rent up. My father always says, if you have a reliable tenant, you should put the rent down.
Keep them.
Because A, they'll stay for a long time. The daftest thing you can do is put the rent up. You lose a reliable tenant. The place is then empty for 4 months, and your reliable tenant is replaced by someone who's a disaster, you know, who destroys the place or generally causes a huge amount of grief. And this business of actually, again, removing information asymmetry in the market, I suppose, by allowing rental tenants to carry a kind of reference with them. And they believe they can actually introduce the deposit-free rental, which is an interesting concept, that once people have established themselves as trustworthy tenants and they have a kind of, you know, it's a bit like your rating on Uber, it makes me behave better. I always say to my children, you know, get out quickly and get in the cab because I don't want to drop below a 4.8. Okay. And in the same way, once people actually over a few years have got a 5-star tenant rating, it's not actually only going to solve the market problem, it's actually going to make tenants behave better, I think, which is probably fantastic.
Good. I think that just leaves us two, and we'll briefly mention them. So Slitherine, fascinating. It's basically computer game software development, but aimed at war simulation for military clients. I was intrigued by this one and liked it, partly because you think of video gaming, although it's a big industry, you think it's somehow, that's a bit of a trivial development. Somehow, is that a waste of great tech talent making video games that teenagers waste their lives playing? But to find applications that are really serious, that, you know, could have a geopolitical impact, I thought that was very interesting. Rory, did you?
I thought it was fascinating. That one. And apparently they do have some sort of consumer link with the consumer games industry. Yeah. But they've clearly, with a rather wonderfully sinister name, Slitherine, I think. But they seem to be doing work with, sort of, you know, you can imagine the whole sort of Department of Defense clients and military clients taking this to a very, very serious level. I think it's very, very important, actually, just for the whole scenario planning thing, that, I mean, essentially, I suppose it's a flight simulator in the sense that the great thing about a flight simulator is it allows you to try things in the virtual world that would be rather dangerous to attempt in reality. And I have to say, this is a fascinating... bizarrely, it seems to be family-funded. And the turnover of 7.5 million is interesting. It's also unusually making a profit. Mm. Whatever next.
So our last one, Tracy, is Peanut, which is a social network, it says, for like-minded mamas. I thought perhaps you might have a comment on that one. Did you like that one?
I did. My initial reaction was, where's the differentiation in terms of this as a particular app and a particular product? But I think definitely filling a need within the community of mothers that are feeling isolated and lonely, and it gives them the opportunity to create a social network amongst themselves. As I began to read this and hear about how they want to create an environment to empower women, I was thinking, well, with all of the stories around the female agenda generally, I think that the concept of creating networks where like-minded people can get together and share experiences and ideas is a good thing. I haven't quite seen how you sort of build something that you can take to the next stage, but I think definitely filling a very great need.
Rory, are we anywhere near the sort of peak social networking, as it were, or is it endless iterations?
I mean, this is something different. I mean, my only question is, are there not Facebook groups, for example, or parts of Mumsnet which would serve the same function? On the other hand, this is emphatically different in the sense that particularly, I'll make a prediction about this, particularly around the first child, once you've got one child, the heir and the spare thing almost works. It's very interesting that people, when they have a second or third or fourth child, they start buying own brand nappies. They stop worrying about hygiene so much. It's a rather terrifying reflection on human nature. But around the first child, there is a huge and disproportionate level of anxiety and therefore a search for shared experience. And so this isn't the usual network of your friends or your mum or whatever. This is a network of people who are in this exactly that same very peculiar life stage themselves. So, I mean, they're patently having some success. So we can't, although we don't have any financial figures, they seem to have 300,000 users.
That's
from
impressive.
Only 9 months' existence. Mm. So it's serving some kind of need. Mm.
Good. Well, there we are. I'm going to draw to a close now. Thank you both very much for all those interesting and lively comments. We're going on to the other regions to do similar podcasts, but I think we've got off to a great start. So thank you both very much indeed. Thank you.
Pleasure.
You.